listening to the best of A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. We can't take your phone calls today, but please enjoy this program.
Happy Tuesday, and welcome to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Four Arrows, co-author of the book Restoring the Kinship Worldview, Indigenous Voices Introduced 28 Precepts for Rebalancing Life on Planet Earth. Now, I had to look up the definition of precept to help me with the conversation, and a precept is a general rule intended to regulate behavior or thought. And this book includes 28 different speeches from Indigenous leaders from around the world who each are sharing their wisdom and a direction and ideas to help move us away from our current path towards extinction and onto a sustainable and interconnected future. And Four Arrows co-authored this book with his partner, Darshan Narvaez. And Dr. Narvaez was actually on the program before talking about her recent book or her upcoming book, The Evolved Nest. And if you get a chance, I highly recommend going back and looking for that conversation with Dr. Narvaez, because her lens in looking at child rearing practices, Indigenous child rearing practices, is life-changing. But for our conversation today, when I first started talking to Four Arrows, just trying to get into kind of his resume and his biography and how he got to be a part of the Kinship Worldview movement, but also how he became to be known as Four Arrows, that took the first half of our conversation. Because if you ever met someone whose life is so big, their personality so expansive, their interests so diverse that you can't encapsulate them in a paragraph, that's the way Four Arrows is. We were all over the place with all of the different things that he understands, the knowledge that he's gained throughout the course of his lifetime. And it's clear in talking to him that he is so full of passion and this drive to make sure that he shares everything he knows with as many people as possible, so that these messages, this information that he's gained throughout his lifetime, will be shared in a vast way to make a difference in the world. And so in doing that and having that conversation, I realized that we probably need to set some context for who Four Arrows is, so it's easier to follow along where we seem to bounce in our conversation. So Four Arrows professionally is internationally respected for his research and publications about Indigenous worldview. He's the former Dean of Education at Oglala Lakota College. He's a former associate tenured professor of education at Northern Arizona University. He's currently a professor at Fielding Graduate Institute. He's the author of 23 books. He was named one of 27 visionaries in education. He holds two PhDs, two doctoral degrees, one in health psychology and another in curriculum and instruction. Four Arrows is the co-founder of Veterans for Peace, Chapter 100 in Northern Arizona. He is the recipient of the Martin Springer Institute Award for Moral Courage. He was selected by the Alternative Education Resource Organization as one of 27 visionaries in education. His book, Teaching Truly, A Curriculum to Indigenize Mainstream Education, was listed as one of 20 books of all time for progressive education by the Chicago Wisdom Project. And on top of that, he plays handball, he does stand-up paddleboard, he surfs, but he was also first alternate for the U.S. Equestrian Endurance Team for the 1996 Olympics, riding a Mustang that he captured and trained himself. And he is also a world champion old-time piano player. And that's just the surface. We go much deeper into all of the different talents that this man has. And throughout the hour, we'll be referring to the Indigenous worldview and the dominant worldview and how these two different lenses or perspectives influenced how we have lived on the planet. And Four Arrows references a chart showing these different worldviews and how they align or don't align, how they are different. And if you're interested in finding out more about the worldview chart, you can visit kindred.media.org. And kindredmedia.org has a copy of the chart. You can download them and look at the chart, follow along to give more context for what we were talking about. And also Kindred Media, One Family, One World, has podcasts, videos, resources, and different articles to expand the ideas on the kinship worldview. So that's where we're going today, a conversation with four arrows. You can get in touch with me after the show by sending an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, leave me a message there. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can also podcast our show by going wherever it is you get your podcasts, put in a conversation with a reluctant therapist, hit subscribe, leave a review, and you'll be able to listen at your convenience. So we're going to take a quick break and come back and start our conversation with Four Arrows. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
This is the best of a conversation with the reluctant therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
The night is coming now, have you heard? And through the town, they're spreading the word. So build a fire and settle down. Until I see you again. The night is coming now, have you heard? And through the town, they're spreading the word. So sleep by the river and move along. Until I see you again. Stay warm, sleep by the river. Stay warm till I see you again.
Stay. Let's rock and roll.
Okay. Are you at home right now?
I am. And if we had time, I would take you on a tour.
Well, I have tons of time. I don't want to take you.
Oh, here, let me take you on a little tour then. I am in Jalisco, Mexico, halfway between Manzanillo and Puerto Vallarta. This is my yard. I live pretty much off of the garden. This is the little, and we're surrounded by thousands of hectares of wilderness that has been put into a preserve. So we've got all boa constrictors and jaguars and eight different kinds of wild cats. Here's a tree. If you stand under it long enough, you live to 102.
Oh, wow.
And that's this is like at the best, about 90 steps from my house is the best longboard surfing in the world. And so I've become a 77-year-old surf bum, and I love every minute of it. And this is my church. I do, of course, Lakota and Ipi ceremonies, but I built a Mayan, what they call a Temescal, to honor the people here. So, yeah, so that's where I live.
How did you find your way to this place in Jalisco?
Well, we lived in Bahia de Quino across the Arizona border, and I was working with the Seri Indians, also known as the Kunkha. And a friend of mine from the University of Arizona, Gary Nabham, said, I need you to help me to stop a shrimp farm, a huge shrimp farm that they're building. And I was kind of ignorant about shrimp farms. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? I love shrimp. He said, do your research. I'll be down in two weeks. And I did the research and was blown away. And if you go online, just put in the shrimp habit, how it's destroying our world, and showing about the rape of women and the destruction of mangrove swamps and the poisoning of shrimp. And so I wrote it to stop it. Well, one day, one of the Seri Indians came to me, who was a good friend of Bee's, my wife, and he said, you have to leave Bahia de Quino within 24 hours, like an old West movie.
Yeah.
And I said, well, what are you joking? I'm serious. His friend, and also one of the 900 Seri Indians that live out in the desert, was a contract hitman for the Mexican mafia. And the governor of Sonora was the owner of the farm. And, more journalists are killed in Mexico. I don't know if you know that.
No, I did not.
More journalists, environmental journalists are killed in Mexico than any country. We've had 19 already just this year. And so they put a contract on me. So B and I left the house, went back to Canada, left the boat, left everything. And I said, let's find a place on a clean lake as far away as we can get and find the nearest town and we'll move there. And that's what we did.
So is the contract still out on you?
No, I don't think so. It's been, oh my God, 20 years. So I think we're safe now.
Okay, good. That's good. I don't have a huge goal for our interview. I really wanted to just get to know you. I'd love you to introduce yourself and how you would like my listeners to know you.
I'm saying my name again, and it's Wahik Petopa of Four Arrows, and offering everyone a warm handshake that's out there listening to us today, and letting you know that I'm speaking from my heart. I am a member of the Medicine Horse Teospaye of the Oglala Lakota. I'm a Hunka, which is a maid relative. My ancestry blood is storified Irish and Shilagi or Cherokee, but with no tribal membership to the Cherokee, I wound up out of university with my doctoral degree right into Pine Ridge as director of the Oglala Lakota College Education Program. And we'll talk a little bit about how I got there. But wound up being fulfilling my Sundance vows and went through one of the seven sacred ceremonies of the Lakota, which include the Sundance and the Vision Quest and the Purification Lodge, and that is the making of a relative. So my spirit won't go to Ireland and or to the Cherokee land. It will go to where the Lakota go. My work is about two ideas today. One is an idea that is something we can only support and not really embrace fully, and that is indigenous place-based wisdom and knowledge. I say that we can't because it can only come from those who speak the language fluently, the home language, because the languages of indigenous people are from the earth and that place. So one must know the language, one must know the ceremonies that honor those places and have lived in multi-generations prior to colonialization to know that land. So there's very few of us that have that claim in the United States territories, but there are some. And of course, around the world, there are a number that against all odds are holding on and fighting for it. So first thing that I want to say is we're not going to talk much about that today. Okay. We're going to talk more about what all of us can do and what most of your listeners can do. And that is that there is a in common theme of worldview precepts that all of these place-based cultures have. And it's well recognized amongst the peoples. I was just back from Colombia with the Kogi, and in spite of the very different spiritual traditions and beliefs, it was amazing how identical it was to the other people I've lived with, the Rarámuri here in Mexico and of course the Lakota. And so this idea of worldview is what I want to talk about. And its importance, its history, it's not the best word, I don't think, but we I've looked for other ones like existence scape and all these other things, because indigenous worldview isn't about seeing, it's about being. And I'll just close that introduction by saying it has especially started to take shape now that the University of California, Berkeley, and their prestigious Science Center for the Greater Good chose our book as one of the top 15 thought-provoking, inspiring, and practical books of the 2022 year. And that's after 35, 36 years of doing this, I think that is showing me, along with a lot of other signs, that we all are starting to wake up to the foundational problem that we are facing with a possible sixth mass extinction.
What inspired you to find your I don't know if it's your roots or your story within the Lakota people. What was your journey even getting to that place where you really wanted to commit yourself to your Indigenous roots and then your work as an academic?
Well, Wopila, thank you for that question, because I think it really is a powerful and one that's not often asked of me. I guess I'm going to start with my early childhood, where mom and her five sisters talked a lot about our Cherokee background, but in ways that were more or less demeaning and confusing to me. And there was a lot of alcoholism. And so I grew up sort of without any traditional background, but with that sort of myth hanging over me. I ultimately went into the U.S. Marine Corps. My dad had done 36 combat missions in World War II and died of post-traumatic stress alcoholism when he was 52. And I went in to be a pilot and was disenfranchised when I learned the truth about Vietnam. And so I managed to get an honorable discharge because my grandfather knew a United States senator. And I didn't have the courage of a lot of my other brothers to just resist. So I took the easy way out, came out to California to sail around the world and just put it all behind me. And I did a lot of adventures of sailing and wild horse riding and training and rock climbing, and but mostly whitewater rafting. And I became a firefighter at that time to be able to handle all the days off I could get to go whitewater kayaking. And with a fellow friend named David Carr, we decided to try the Rio Urique here in Mexico. It had never been accomplished, never had been descended, and there were no charts. It's a river. It's in Copper Canyon, so it's 8,000 feet down. It's deeper than the Grand Canyon. But during that trip down, long story short, the entire river disappeared into an underground hole during a rainstorm that took me in, and I had a near-death experience. It was the most beautiful, amazing experience I had ever had. It wasn't until many, many years later when I became an academic that I studied the work at the University of Virginia and other people who have talked about near-death experiences that showed this replication of the beautiful light and all this stuff.
How old were you?
I was in my late 30s, early 40s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And so from there, I went and quit. I was a health psychologist, and I had been teaching hypnosis at UC Berkeley. And I quit everything, and I said, I'm going to go back, and I want to get an education. I don't want to do postvention anymore, because now I know prevention, because it was a 15-year process where I went back and stayed with the Rarámuri people who rescued me from the river. We could not continue down the river. It was like Niagara Falls. And we would not have made it up had not the Rarámuri come and show us the way out of this 8,000-foot canyon. And so I was so impressed with their living in caves, but their happiness, their joy, their sense of purpose. It just changed me. It just changed me, as did the event itself. I learned from Agustin Ramos that particular hole in the middle of the river with canyons going up 2,000 feet, walls going up 2,000 feet, had been used for shaman initiations. They would take people who had potential to be one, and they would go upstream and let them go. And inside this big boulder are about seven openings, only one big enough for a human being. If you struggled, you could be pushed into one that would hold you. But if you felt relaxed and you stayed with it, as happened to me miraculously, because I didn't know any of this, you would come out the main one, and then you would begin the shaman's. That's why I call it the shaman's message. And so I came back to Boise State University, got my doctorate in education curriculum with an emphasis on Indigenous worldview. And the spirits had it that my first job was as a director of education on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota at Oglala Lakota College. So that's how I got started in this.
And so what were you anticipating you would be doing with the newfound doctorate and work? Like, what was your goal when you started?
Well, you know, of course, I had no goals except for taking the chip off my shoulder by doing the adventures. But after what happened to me in the hole, the near-death experience, I had had a Mustang, a wild horse, from the Bureau of Land Management, waiting for me, and I had not been able to touch it. I had been macho, and I wanted to train a wild horse as part of my deal. I couldn't get near it. When I came back, it just walked right up to me. In fact, another recommendation for you, if you just go on YouTube and put in the horse hypnotist, you'll see Evening Magazine with Richard Hart. They asked me to bring in a wild horse, and you'll see me get on a wild rearing horse and hypnotizing Richard to walk up to it. I couldn't do any of that before the trip. So when I came back, it was like, what has happened to me? And I spent 15 years trying to figure it out. When I did figure it out, I came up with the idea of the cat and the fawn.
Okay.
Now, this is going to be kind of unique on your program because of all the programs I've done. I haven't talked much about a cat fawn. CAT stands for Concentration Activated Transformation. It's a sense of, if you will, the concept of hypnosis or trance-based learning. Fear, fawn, stands for fear, authority, words, and nature. And the reason that came to me in my vision shortly after, before we got out of the canyon, after we had to leave because, you know, we couldn't go any further. And I survived. I obviously came out of the hole, and David had portaged around, but we couldn't get out of the river except in a cave that we found. And each day we had to go higher in that cave because the water kept rising. And when we got with about 5 feet of wall above us, knowing that we would drown if it continued, a mountain lion called an Onso walked right over our sleeping bags on this ledge we were on at night. And David and I, like, were a couple of kids, and we went, Jesus, did that just happen? You know, that kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
But it let us out. And then on the way out, we bumped into La Ramory Indian people who would come down from nowhere and show us a way when we would get lost because we were in the Broncas and there was no trail. And one of them was carrying a fawn, baby deer. The Tarahumara are famous for their running ability. And they would run the deer down and then knock it out and bring it back for food. So the cat was the mountain lion. The fawn was the fawn. Turned into neon lights, Elizabeth, like in New York City. CAT flashing on and on. FAWN flashing on and off. And I spent 15 years trying to figure that out. And that's before I went to Boise State. And when I figured it out, I realized what it was in short is the beginning of understanding a different worldview as relates to fear, authority, words, and nature. So just to be brief, and indigenous ways of looking at fear are about courage as the ultimate beginning place, followed by, once you commit to action, a trust in the universe.
Mm-hmm.
You know what fear is in the rest of the world, right? I won't go into it. Authority in the indigenous worldview, the highest authority is your own reflection on lived experience with recognition that everything is connected. I don't need to go in to say where our authority comes from in the dominant worldview. So, you know, I could spend a lot of time on that.
We'll just say the patriarchy and move on.
Yeah. And then you go to words. I found living with the Indians in my study and later my friend Tom Cooper's book, A Time Before Deception, there were no words for lying. My people, the Lakota, did ceremony when the treaties first started being broke because we thought, the treaty signers must have a mental illness and they don't see reality, right? So words were sacred vibrations, not what is little four-year-olds are starting to do now, you know, lying and lying and lying, and I don't need to say much about that. And then, of course, the last one, nature. And you have a painting behind you of a person like in a womb that's in the roots of a tree underground. I mean, we are nature. But if you look up nature in Webster's and other dictionaries, it says everything but humans are what humans make, right? That's how far we've gone, right? So what I suggest as a psychologist at the time, because I was still working as a psychologist clinically, and teaching hypnosis, which is, I think, maybe why the concentration activated transformation came up at UC Berkeley, is that metacognitive reflection on the worldview. And at that time, we hadn't created all 40 precepts. I was just talking about those four. And that's whatever problem you bring in to psychology, what does it have to do with what you're afraid of? And where did that fear come from? Mm-hmm. On whose authority do you have it? What words were involved with it, or do you say to yourself about it? Mm-hmm. And in what ways have you used nature as a teacher? And just doing that metacognitively with that reflection and being aware of cat, that cat is probably what got you there, especially during early childhood when we're in a state of hypnosis almost continually. So like you can learn 10 languages if you grow up in age 3 to 4, right? And so that, I see how that happened. I had that trauma, and that trauma is what brought me into this place. And, you know, now we go, okay, and now I realize that I've been misdirecting myself with this worldview, an incorrect worldview, this dominant worldview precept that relates to fear, that relates to truthfulness, or that relates to authority, or that relates to nature.
And then the words, probably the DSM, right? The book that describes mental illness, all those words that have created that or instilled that belief, that wrong belief.
Yeah, and the DSM, I remember there was a disorder that says an example of it would be talking to a rock and thinking that it would answer. And I thought, wait a minute, I just come back from people who do that, right? You know, so no wonder all indigenous people are still in the horrors of the scientific, rejection of indigeneity. Right. And so, and then, of course, you know, the nature, and then use the hypnosis to imagine how to get back into it. Well, that's the cat fawn connection. Well, now, of course, we have, with a lot of scholarship over the years, we've recognized this concept of a worldview and the 40 worldview precepts. I thought, you know, I've experienced it firsthand. I've been transformed myself. I've seen it with the people. During that 15 years, I had also visited other indigenous cultures that had not been Christianized. And I thought, I want to go and get a credible degree as my second doctorate that is in curriculum so that I can teach this as a preventive for what's ahead of us. And that was my main goal.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Four Arrows, co-author of the book, Restoring the Kinship Worldview, Indigenous Voices Introduced 28 Precepts for Rebalancing Life on Planet Earth. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation about the kinship worldview and the chart showing the differences between a dominant worldview and an Indigenous worldview. You're tuned in and listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
This is the best of A Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Nothing that we needed, at least not at this time. And now the feeling that I'm feeling with, it's feeling like my life is finally mine. Nothing to go back to, we just continue to drive. And without you, I was broken, but I'd rather be broke down with you by now.
So what would be the best words to describe who you are?
I would say I'd like to introduce my guest, Four Arrows, who's a human being.
I like that. Four Arrows, when we're talking about a worldview, I'll give you the brief sentence I have and then you can correct me, but that there is the worldview that all of
nature is alive and sentient, and we are just as human beings part of the natural world that is alive and active and energized, versus the worldview that there are humans and everything else is not living. And in that worldview that we've developed in our colonized Western model of humanity, when you look at the world as a dead object, it's easier to exploit the resources and the lands. And one of the things that I read in the book was that according to the United Nations 2019 global assessment, that 75% of our land-based environment and 66% of our marine environments have already been significantly altered by human actions that are tied to this belief that the world is here for us to exploit. And yet, on average, the 20% or so of the lands that are still under the control or managed by Indigenous peoples have not seen or had as severe an impact in the world or the land around them because of their worldview that all things are living and energized and sentient. And that what you're trying to bring forth is a story of for everyone to understand that we are part of a natural world that is living and sentient and energized, and we need to create an education system that brings human beings back to that belief.
Yes, you said that beautifully. And that's the most important thing. I think I mentioned to you that picture along with the human being in the root of the tree says it all. But I think hope needs to be redefined. I think hope, because the numbers of people that will continue to see the trees and the rivers as resources at best, right? Let alone being afraid of them or not even thinking about them. As opposed to relatives, which is what we have to start calling them. It's not changing. It's changing, but not at the big levels of corporatism, right? And so I think a better definition for being a human being, and I got that from Sitting Bull. That was somebody asked him, how in the throes of smallpox, with all the buffalo killed, you're being chased. You know, he was in prison when he was asked this. How did you manage to continue to write poetry and Sundance and sing and be generous? And he said, because I'm a human being. That was where I got that. And so what we have to do is redefine hope. Hope is not certainty of an outcome. I see so many of my fellow activists burning out. They'll go, I did 4 tours of duty at Standing Rock, and you see people burning out because now, you know, the oil is leaking and that, you know, what was the point of it? Change the definition and the activists start to not burn out. Change it to an absolute convinced belief that whatever you're doing is the right thing to do, regardless of the outcome. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden you begin to fall into place with these worldview precepts like trusting the universe, right? And understanding spirit. And so absolutely the one worldview precepts, but they're all interconnected. We can't disconnect the concept of personal vitality from the laws of nature or for the animistic and biocentric understanding and the empathy and the competition to develop potential instead of superiority. In other words, when we think about we are part of nature, there are all these moral precepts that have to coincide with it. And that's the excitement, I think, that has been drawn to our worldview chart.
But also, I'm curious to know, I want to make sure that we're explaining description, but if we're explaining what the worldview, the kinship worldview looks like.
Let's try it from a historical perspective real briefly.
Thank you.
The idea of worldview originally mm-hmm. was something that really stopped dialogue. It was science versus religion, because it was a German philosopher that mentioned the word and it just caught on like wildfire. And it was about science versus religion. Then it became religion versus religion. In fact, if you put in worldview and Amazon.com, 90% of thousands of books will be all religions, right? But it has matured in the academy since the 1930s when a anthropologist, a social anthropologist named Robert Redfield at the University of Chicago brought it up. He believed there were only, in 1930, only three worldviews. Now, you know, Elizabeth, that most people think, oh, there's a billion worldviews. Everybody has one. Well, that waters it down to where it's meaningless, right? And so he said, there's three. But by the 50s, he was saying there's two, because the Eastern one still had the spiritual traditions much closer to indigeneity, but had largely in their institutions subsumed the Western. He says there's just two. And the greatest tragedy of human history is the loss of the indigenous worldview, the overshadowing of it. So the idea of worldview now is no longer about stifling dialogue. It's about encouraging it, because we're all in the same boat, the same sinking boat, that we have the option to look at practical ideas that are what the human being's relationship to nature, to one another, and to supernature. That's now the operational definition of worldview, is who we are in relationship to ourselves, to nature, and to whatever metaphysical things are in the spirit world. And when you really get to that, that's when you begin to see, wow, why am I homophobic? Why am I materialistic? Why am I? You begin to see, because I have this materialistic worldview that was put into me, and it's such an exciting thing. I mean, I'm working with some students at the First University in Haiti to decolonize their entire doctoral program. I'm working with the Veterans for Peace, of which I was I formed the chapter in Northern Arizona. I was president of it. They want to decolonize the mechanisms of it. I've got so many students who are using the worldview chart excitedly to say, oh my gosh, this is how we have to change education, right?
At what point did the dead earth worldview supersede the indigenous worldview of all things are living? When did that split happen?
Well, nobody knows, but I wrote a whole book about it, but nobody knows. The name of the book is Point of Departure, which is answering your question. And the best we can understand is around 9 to 10,000 years ago in the area where Turkey is, right? And it was the beginning. It was probably a couple of indigenous people who lost faith, right, in the laws of nature. And they had maybe, this is hypothetical, they maybe had an abundance of surplus of corn and things. And because we all indigenous origin stories, all of them, talk about potential of greed and jealousy. I mean, so we know that that's part of humans. You know, this worldview does not belong to indigenous people or a group. You know, the place-based knowledge does, but not the worldview. Anything indigenous to planet Earth belongs to that, right? And so somehow maybe they just started going, well, you know what? Let's make you a king and I'll be a king. And something happened that caught on like wildfire. And then you began to see the beginning of the first civilizations practicing hierarchy. And it went from there. So that would be the answer to the question as a hypothetical. And so that means we have been practicing our indigenous worldview. If you believe that 2 million years was the first toolmakers, for 99.9% of our history. So this has just been a fraction of time that we've gone off on the wrong side, you know?
It's just so fascinating to me that it did catch on. Like, what would compel people to abandon what was a life-preserving, thriving way of being a human being to basically becoming a slave to agriculture and a slave to having to pay for food that grew freely all around us? Like, how did that? I'm so curious about how that became so compelling, because human beings left what made sense.
That's why the origin stories, you know, all the that's the main myth of the indigenous people, that there's twins, sometimes a man and woman, sometimes two women. And And these twins, Iroquois twin hero story, to show that one twin was kind of bad and one was good. But it wasn't that way. It was like one was about freezing cold and one was about summer. So, but you can't really call that good and bad in a sense, right? But it was used to show how easy it is to move into a place where you overemphasize one. This is in our human imagination. That's why animals are our teachers. They don't imagine the possibility of being a millionaire while everybody else is struggling, right? So this is just in there. But the laws of nature were working so well for so long until that anomaly happened and caught on. Well, a lot of indigenous people are still holding on. And you were correct in citing the United Nations. And the title of my article in The Nation is called "The Media Missed an Important Message in the UN Biodiversity Report," you know, because it didn't get talked about. It talked about the million more extinctions, but it didn't say that where indigenous worldview is operating, the extinction rate is almost nothing. And that's why 80% of the biodiversity, as you said, on Mother Earth is on the 3% of the population that controls 20% of the land, right? So we can do this. We can do this. It's just right now, people are waking up, but the powers that be are not.
If you're just tuning in, my guest today is Four Arrows, co-author of the book we're discussing, Restoring the Kinship Worldview, Indigenous Voices Introduced 28 Precepts for Rebalancing Life on Planet Earth. Four Arrows is internationally respected for his research and publications about Indigenous worldviews. He is currently a professor at Fielding Graduate Institute and the author of 23 other books, and was named one of 27 visionaries in education. We now continue our conversation here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
We've got things happening. They're happening, right?
The Klamath peoples have taken back control of the river and the restoration. And I know in Montana, the return of the water rights. I mean, yes, things are happening.
But you very rightly talked about place-based knowledge and how they're in Klamath, the Indians are coming, bringing it back, right? So I want to just let your listeners know that as vital as it is to support indigenous sovereignty of local places, we have to recognize that most of them have lost the worldview. Mm. And so this isn't about just reclaiming land. This isn't about just, you know, those are vital for the sake of people who have a knowledge about that land because the language is of the land, right? And I don't want to minimize that. I want to maximize that. But I also want to say, if the rest of the people that are so-called non-Indigenous, everybody's Indigenous if you go back far enough. But if those who don't consider themselves Indigenous don't get on this bandwagon, if you will, there's just not enough. 80% of my Navajo students, I have them, they say 80% of their nation, that's the biggest one in the United States, have lost it.
So the importance is reawakening the Indigenous worldview for all human beings. We use the word, you know, colonization or decolonizing pretty freely from an academic standpoint, but I think it's important to define what that actually means in the real world to how we're living today.
Sure. Well, I mean, you're right. It's overused. Decolonization is looking for those things that are oppressive, because colonization is oppressive, right? And so the opposite of exclusion is not inclusion. The opposite of exclusion is decolonization.
Okay.
Okay. But that's kind of looking at, oh, here's a problem. Well, so now what? Everybody's been in critical pedagogy has addressed these problems, and holistic education. You know, a lot of people have addressed these problems, but we haven't solved them. Why? Because we've forgotten that decolonization refers to pre-colonization. Well, what does that mean? That means going to something that happened before colonization that worked. Well, it's not living in a teepee. You know, it's not, you know, hunting buffalo. What is it? It's worldview. That's the only thing different. the colonized worldview is all those precepts that your listeners will find on the right side of the chart. Those are all things that are necessary for colonization and oppression, and they're necessary for hegemony, which is a fancy word for how we are led to believe that what we're doing is a good thing when really it's a colonized thing, right? I always used to tell I would give presentations to educators, I say, who knows why Helen Keller is a classic example of educational colonization and hegemony? And only a few people would raise their hand, and they usually got it wrong, you know, because people don't know that most of us who learned about Helen Keller learned who she was as a deaf and you know, they didn't know she was the courageous person that filled Carnegie Hall up to speak out against World War I. They don't know that she was a member of the International Workers of the World, most radical labor union against child labor. That she was a member of the Socialist Party because of her disdain for capitalism. That, you know, on and on and on. We grew up not learning these things because education said, whoa, that would be decolonizing, right? And then if you went deeper into what the things that she did do, you start to see generosity is the highest thing, courage. You start to see these precepts, right? So that is what is missing in the decolonization movement, is the indigenization movement. Now, is it more controversial? Oh, you bet. You're going to be, you know, as quote, a white person, even me, you know, as a mixed blood, I have my lot of my dear Sun Branch brothers and sisters will say, taking this into education is the worst thing that you could be doing for us. That's where the problems happen. Everything's been stolen for us. Now education's going to steal it. To address this, I recommend if somebody wants to look at it, my article, a peer-reviewed article at the University of British Columbia's journal Critical Education, is called The Indigenization Controversy, For Whom, By Whom. And you can see by that title that I address this in detail, right?
I can imagine, though, for us, that there would be a lot of anxiety and concern about bringing the indigenous worldview into schools because of Indian schools and, you know, how we've used education to program people to see the world through the current colonized lens. So I would imagine that anything that looks at all like public education would cause anxiety.
Oh, absolutely. And it would cause anxiety for just to see non-Indian people teaching Indian spirituality, right? Yes. And what I say is you have to have empathy and understanding for that concern. It's legitimate. You have to understand where it comes from, but I'm asking you to make a choice. And if you look at the worldview chart, the indigenous worldview itself would say, no, this belongs to everyone. Fool's Crow, one of the champions of the Lakota spiritual leaders, says, anyone not willing to share this medicine does not know this medicine. Now, is there a risk? There certainly is. But does it have to be done? Yes, and that's why I make this distinction between place-based wisdom that we've got to support that none of us are going to gain. That you have to have been there and know that language and the worldview, which is going to cause us to re-indigenize ourselves where we don't have that help of people who still remember.
So, moving forward with this indigenous worldview, something you said early on in the hour, I just can't get out of my head and I want to go back to it. You talked about how children live in a state of trance or from the time they're young. I don't know if the word you used was trance, but, and they're so able to learn so many things. And so what I'm hearing is that we start with the young children and how we raise them so that what they come up with is this natural, they already have the affinity for being part of the natural world. That's how they're born. They come into that and we actually educate that out of them is what I'm understanding, right? Mm-hmm. We educate that knowing out of them. And so what is this period of time that they're come into the world in this little bubble? What do you mean by that? And how do we help to not pop that bubble and colonize their thinking.
This is why my co-author for this book, Restoring Our Kinship Worldview, is Darsha Narvaez. Her work in showing how when children are in the womb and the kind of nurturing and reinforcement of the indigenous worldview and how that continues during those hypnotic years, the first 5 years, you know, she shows how it produces a completely different adult than what we're seeing today. So, you know, I in our dialogue, she talks about how to bring that from coming up. Whereas my work is, you know, well, how do we take where we've gone astray and get us back on the path?
People are afraid of misstepping.
It's changed now because of kind of some rethinking on this. To answer your question is, there's no right or wrong here. It's true that it could be misappropriated by people and will be misappropriated. It's also true that majority of indigenous people have lost their way. It's also true that we are facing horrible futures for our future generations. So all these things are true. So if the evidence for saying, if I move to a worldview, don't call it indigenous. Call it an earthly worldview if you want to avoid it. I'm moving over to this worldview. I mean, I've thought about that often, that don't call it an indigenous worldview. But then if I do that, then the empathy and the activism in behalf of indigenous peoples is lessened. Right. When I get a Navajo student who's been Christianized and doesn't remember her ceremony or our language, I start teaching her this worldview, they cry. They get it back. And they mean, you mean my world? That's my worldview? Yeah. And you mean that worldview is important? Ah! So once that worldview becomes, and it is becoming, recognized as important more and more and more. And when shows like yours have the courage to show and talk like this, you know, these are the people have to hear this. The people who have to be able to say, why should I challenge Columbus Day when it, you know, it's such a great holiday? And, you know, we've got to look at this from the point of view that this is a worldview that belongs to no one but those who are indigenous to Mother Earth. And the only reason that we call it indigenous with a capital I is because against all odds, indigenous peoples have managed to hold on to it more so than those who have bought into settler coloniality. Does that make sense? That we are human. I'm a human being. Now, I don't have to be able to speak my lost indigenous language to say I'm a human being. You know, I don't have to know the ceremonies to say I'm a human being. But I can study the worldview precepts that are common to all indigenous peoples, whether they've remembered them or not. And if those worldview precepts are about how to be a human being, one of the species.
It's almost as if you're describing... It's almost like you're creating an earth Bible. People spend their life searching for the right way to live, right? They're looking at the Bible and they're looking at meditation. They're looking at mental health care. Like, what's the right place to live? And the precepts, and boy, I sure hope that the definition of precepts is understood.
Yeah. So precepts, yeah. It's like, I mean, if I were to Google it right now and put in the word precept, it simply means that it is a general rule. Okay. Intended to help guide behavior or thought.
Right. Okay? So we've got these 40 precepts that come with the indigenous worldview. And if people are searching for this path, you would be able to say, go read these precepts and it'll give you.
No. I would say practice them.
Okay, better. Yes.
This is because one of the precepts is you cannot have thought without action, right? So this is why the precepts are so important, right? Because they'll catch you. Everyone, you can choose one. No, this isn't like the Bible. In the Bible, you can choose one thing and say, that's fine. And then say, well, no, but I'm going to accept the other one. That's not, you know, you pick and choose. You can't pick and choose with the worldview chart. They not only do you have to have all the alignments between the 40 on the indigenous side, they have to be in relationship to those on the dominant side, right? And so it's an exciting process. And all of it are all based on our inseparability from the air, the mountains, the water, the lands, that we cannot stop remembering that right now, as we are breathing, we're in partnership with the oceans and the plants and the trees.
And so in our closing minutes together, coming from kind of that mental health lens that I live in, it appears to me when I read through the precepts that if someone were coming to me and they're struggling with anxiety, depression, phobias, to hand them these precepts and say, follow these, practice these, and you'll alleviate your mental health issues. What do you think about that?
Yeah, you'll go out of business, but it's beautiful.
That's okay.
So, you know, it's putting self-help into a whole new category. But psych, and this is what I'm going to be, maybe you should help me write this article for the General Psychology Review, because this is what I want to try to answer that question in there. And well, I'm afraid it's going to be one page.
but I think it has to be the future of psychotherapy, because from my perspective, three reasons. One, we're telling people the story that if we had more mental health care, we wouldn't have the problems we have in the world, which is a myth. And so we either have to let people know, no, there is no mental health care that solves the world problems. But once we destabilize everyone by telling them there is no mental health care that's going to solve the world's problem, we have to have something to replace it with, which has been the ongoing problem. We don't have the backup. That's why I'm looking at the precepts and just how is it that we live. That's why I love, you know, all of the nature-based work. It's, you know how to live. You just need to be reminded. And then the third place is all of the pushback you get from my profession, which you started saying, we're the most colonized profession. We trade on convincing people that the story is correct and they're broken, instead of saying, no, the story is broken and you're just fine, but we don't know what other story to live. So those are my three. Those are the three.
Oh, those are beautiful. Those are beautiful. And I'm going to come call you and so I can quote you in the article on those, because those are beautiful. So, yeah, in essence, what we're really trying to do is we're trying to bring ourselves back to a nature-based, without that sounding like some kind of thing where we run around naked, right?
I know.
Yeah.
You've been listening to my conversation with Four Arrows, co-author of the book Restoring the Kinship Worldview, Indigenous Voices Introduced 28 Precepts for Rebalancing Life on Planet Earth. If you'd like to find out more about these worldviews and the difference between the dominant worldview and the Indigenous worldview, you can visit kindredmedia.org and you can download the chart there, find out all 40 of the different aspects of the dominant versus Indigenous worldview. You can also find out more about the idea of the one family, one world of Kindred Media. They have podcasts, videos, and other resources for you to peruse. As always, I appreciate supporting the show, being part of our community. You can listen to previous shows at kcbx.org. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, or you can podcast the show to listen at your convenience. We'll finish the show with some music played by our guest, Four Arrows. Thank you for tuning in, listening, and supporting Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Kashira, Wakanta, Nama, Kompuna, Teohatop, and Aushi Maka, Ahito Ayam Kelo. Ojate, ojasi unči u čalopu na očak je pohećo u to zanivašte, on ju je pitevo. Ojate, ojasi unčaku luto ohtla mani u očak je po. O kiči api, o ki o kipi aki. Elizabeth, ako hrte. Nishante a tavo, ogala ki na na peči u zepevo. I hani lako, uičo hanki, kim kaši, kik suje. I tako je, jasno. Thank you.